You're listening to audio from The Village Church, a community that's formed by the gospel and sent on God's mission, gathering weekly in the heart of downtown Hamilton, Ohio. For more information about The Village or to connect with us, you can find us online at myvillagechurch.com.
Ecclesiastes 2, starting in 18. I hated all my work that I labored at under the sun, because I must leave it to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will take over my work that I had labored at skillfully under the sun. This, too, is futile. So I began to give myself over to despair concerning all my work that I had labored at under the sun. When there is a person whose work was done with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, he must give his portion to a person who has not worked for it. This too is futile and a great wrong. For what does a person get with all his work and all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? For all his days are filled with grief, and his occupation is sorrowful. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is futile. There is nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I have seen that even this is from God's hand, because who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? For to the person who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give to the one who is pleasing in God's sight. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. This is the word of the Lord. You guys can have a seat.
Good morning. My name is Michael. I'm one of the pastors here. Thanks so much for spending your morning with us. Just a little note, after this gathering, if you are in this room and you've been around for a little bit, or you're trying to figure out kind of how to get connected to a next step, which we talk about all the time, and you want to consider what it looks like to serve, we have a little meeting, a little huddle in those double doors at the very end. Turn left at the couch. You can walk right in there after this gathering, after the benediction. And we just want to share for, 10 or 15 minutes, see what questions you have about serving, but also just kind of let you know why we do what we do, how we do what we do, and how we can get you connected to serving in any outlet that you might want to join in. So just encourage you to do that. Would you pray with me? And then we'll chat about barns and pyramids for a few minutes. Father, thanks for all the ways that you meet us right where we are. Thank you that we are not the center of the universe, even when we live as if we are. Today, would you reorient our lives, not to be so focused on the stuff and the work of our hands and the fruit of our labor, but on the work that you've done that ensures for us, by your grace, through faith in you alone, an inheritance that's everlasting, a life that never tarnishes, never rusts. Would you show us that you are the way to be satisfied, to find joy in our days, in the work of our hands? Thanks so much for meeting us in this place. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, I don't know what you know about Egyptian history, but one theory regarding the pyramids, as monstrous and magnificent as they were and are, is that they were essentially designed to facilitate the pharaohs into the afterlife. And so that's why the central chambers in those huge things were burial rooms filled with gold and jewels and lots of earthly treasures. They were trying to do what we all secretly hope might be possible, and that's to take it with us. That's the ancient version of a modern cliche that I've heard several times since we've started preaching through Ecclesiastes, and it goes like this: you never see a U-Haul behind a hearse, right? We can nod at that, and we can smirk at the visual, but then we just go right back to packing our trailers. And in Luke chapter 12, A man approaches Jesus, and he has that trailer, that U-Haul of his life, all of his things on his mind, and he's concerned about his inheritance. He's worried that he's not getting his fair share, and he essentially says, like, hey, Jesus, will you tell my brother to share? Will you tell my brother to, like, divvy up the inheritance appropriately? And Jesus is like, man, that's not really my concern. But let me tell you a story. And he tells a story about a man who finally managed to pack his trailer perfectly. And this man, he says, his business exploded and his barns were full and his portfolios and his storage units and his safety nets were all in place. And none of those things could hold the harvest that he was reaping. And he does what any of us would. He scales up. He tears those barns down and he builds bigger barns. And he says to himself, self, you have enough. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. He thought that he had finally achieved the gain of his toil by scaling up. But that very night, Jesus says, silence is broken by the voice of God to that man. And he doesn't wake him up and say, hey, we have a few questions. Would you tell us about your success story so we can write about it in the Heavenly Gazette or whatever or anything like that? In fact, he calls him a fool. He says, fool, this night your soul is required of you. Things you have prepared, whose will they be? All your barns, all the things, whose are they? That's the question that haunts every late night at the office and every restless weekend and every audit of our savings accounts. Whose will they be? What was all of this for? Centuries before that conversation with Jesus, there was a teacher, and it's the teacher writing in Ecclesiastes, and most assume it's Solomon, or at least through the like the POV of Solomon, and he had it all. He was king, and he had all the things. He was standing in the middle of his mega barns, and he had palaces and planted vineyards, and he had amassed much gold and silver. But as he looked at the works of his hands, he did not feel rest. The rest that you might think, if you just had all of those things and things were taken care of, that you would feel. In fact, he felt a rising panic, and he realized that the wind of toil, the wind of the work of his hands was blowing through his fingers, and he could not hold on to a single gust of that wind. He realized that the gain of hard work isn't larger barns to give to who knows who, but to delight in the work and the wisdom of God. That's the big idea that we're looking at. The gain of hard work isn't larger barns to give to who knows who, but to delight in the work and the wisdom of God. The first way this shows up is in the hard work of legacy. This is what he says starting in chapter 2, verse 18. He says, I hated all my work that I labored at under the sun because I must leave it to the one who comes after me. If you're just kind of tuning in to Ecclesiastes today, it's a bit of a downer, right? I mean, he's great and done a lot of, he's a bit of a whiner too. And he just, he's into his feels. And so we kind of engage with him, and at our worst and maybe at our best, you can like sit with him in his struggles. And so he says, I must leave it to the one who comes after me. Well, like what is all of my stuff about? I have to leave it to the next guy. And who knows whether he will be wise or he will be a fool. Yet he will take over all my work that I labored at skillfully under the sun. This too is futile. It's vapor. It's nothing. So I began to give myself over to despair concerning all my work that I had labored at under the sun. So this is the next chapter of just like his heart being melted and his soul being crushed. When there was a person whose work was done with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and he must give his portion to a person who has not worked for it, this too is futile, and it's a great wrong. If the tradition is correct and Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes, he isn't being dramatic. He's not being hyperbolic. He's being prophetic because his son, Rehoboam, was the definition of the fool in verse 19. When Solomon died, Solomon was king. He was son of David. David was the best king that Israel ever had, right? He's the esteemed one. And so he has Solomon. Solomon dies. The people ask for a break from their heavy taxes. And the wise old counselors come to him and they say, son, you have an opportunity in front of you. They're saying this to Rehoboam, right? Your father was a tough master. Serve the people and they will follow you. Like, let up a little bit. Like, let them enjoy your kingship. And man, and they will be loyal to you. But he also sought, he got a second opinion, because that one didn't sound that great. And he sought his arrogant friends that he had grew up with. And they didn't tell him that at all. They said, Rehoboam, bro, like, it's us now. You're the king. You're in charge. No, I think you need to show him who's boss. And Rehoboam listened to the fools, and in 15 minutes, the united kingdom of Israel that had been built for two generations, the work of David and Solomon's entire lives, was ripped in half. And Solomon's toil was 40 years of building and taxing and accumulating, and Rehoboam's decision came through 3 days of counseling with his foolish friends, and the result was that the kingdom severed between the north and the south, Israel and Judah, and it was severed before the sun sets on the third day. We read about that in 1 Kings chapter 12. The point is, you can spend 40 years building a masterpiece, and a fool can paint over it in an afternoon. This is why the preacher, the teacher, Solomon, uses the word hated in verse 18. It's the sickening calamity, he says, of working with wisdom and knowledge and skill. He's like, how terrible it is to be so great that I am, right? The curse of beauty that you have given me. Only to have the results handed over to someone who hasn't done a thing to reap the reward. Right? What's crying out of his heart is many things, but one of them, in a sense, it's that justice is on the line. This is not fair. See, there's this natural friction between generations. The older, fearing the incompetence of the youth, the next one up, gosh, they don't get it, and I'm about to hand it off to them. And the younger craving relevance, something that's lasting, something that matters. But either way, whether you're on one side of that or in the middle, you are leaving, whether you're leaving a family business or you're just leaving a clean desk or all your homework done, the anxiety is the same. Who will hold the keys to my empire when I am gone? And see, what we see is that legacy is about so much more than just money. It's about the value of the work of our minutes and days and decades that we have been granted, that we have been allotted. We want to ensure that if we work hard, that the outcome is guaranteed on our terms, and then the results are enduring. Does what I do even matter? Right, and I've worked some jobs where moment by moment, gosh, assembly line stuff where you're just like, does this even matter? And it doesn't matter what you're doing, but the question is, does what I do matter? Is it mean anything beyond me? For the employee, it's the work that you've done with skill and knowledge, as he says, and wisdom, maybe to build a building or a structure or a department or a team culture, but who knows if the new CEO will come in and scrap your 3-year project in a week due to budget cuts. and you didn't make the cut, and you got cut. If you're a parent, you curate your child's life with everything that you have, and you give it your all, and you give them your all. But who knows if they will embrace the things that you embraced, if they'll value the things that you valued, if your life will mean anything, if they will believe the things that you believed, or if they will walk down a path that breaks your heart. You don't know. If you're a church planter, we labor to build a village, right? One that makes, matures, and multiplies disciples. One that's formed by the gospel and sent on mission. One that's about this book and the truth therein, the good news of it. But who knows if the next generation will treasure that same gospel, or they will turn this basement into a CrossFit gym or a yoga studio. The rent's pretty cheap. It's fair. In the ancient world, legacy was everything. That's why you see in the Old Testament and in writings of old so much about like birthrights and stuff that in our modern times, it's like, it doesn't quite, it's hard to connect with. But we still have statues of Greeks and Romans because they cared about what we would think of them thousands of years later. And you might be sitting here and saying, well, I don't care what people think about me in the year 4000. So you're wrong. And I would say, well, that's fine. But you sure do care about what people in the year 2026 think of you. So, ha. I'm not wrong. We care. You don't post a picture before looking at yourself in the mirror, right? And again, the older care about a lasting image because they're closer to the end than the beginning. But the younger, they care about a current image. We still care. Both want our work, the things that we do, to mean something, right? To have value. And that's fine. That's a good thing. But it's just not an ultimate thing. So the warning light of our heart is triggered by the idolatry of control. Idolatry is the idea of worshiping something less than God, right? So the idol of control or power or whatever it is, we are trying to achieve a version of immortality by making sure that our work lasts. And if our bottom line, our primary gain in our work is the product or the outcome or the reputation or maybe even the permanent change that you made in this world, I hear all the time, I just want to do something that matters. Maybe what I would say is the gain is doing whatever you do in a way that matters. Right? I think that's what he's telling us. So no matter what it is, we want to do something that matters. But if those are our primary bottom line, then you're living in the state of constant low-grade panic. And we're saying to ourselves, if I build it well enough, then I will be justified. Or if it lasts, then I mattered. And the teacher's saying, no, I gave in. I gave myself over to despair. That's what he's saying. He realized that again, he brings this up, death is the great equalizer. It strips the wise master of the control of his stuff and certainly of the future. So for us, we are working for the barn of reputation or the barn of leaving something for our kids or if we don't have kids, then for what? Then for the next generation, or you're working for the barn of a ministry that will make an impact, that maybe will be talked about for decades, but the text looks at those things, and it looks at us dead in our eye and asks, who knows? That's the question. Who knows what will become of all of our efforts? And the warning, if you are exhausted today, it might not be your workload. And I'm not minimizing 5 a.m. and 12 or 14-hour days. It's hard. Not minimizing the desire to be comfortable or secure, right? But the warning is, if you're exhausted today, it might not be your workload. It might be the idolatry of legacy that you're worshiping instead of the one true God. We try to carry the who knows of the future on our shoulders. And you're trying to guarantee that your work matters by making it foolproof. But the wind is coming for your barns, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. Hear me, we must look beyond these days and this sun, and we must work hard. And there's virtue and value in that. We must care about what's next and invest in future generations, because it does matter. It's not for nothing. Your days and your moments are not for nothing, but it's also not everything. And that's the heartbeat of the cry of these pages. If your legacy is your everything, then your heart can never be at rest. The second thing we see is the hard work of restless sorrow. For what does a person get with all his work and all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? For all his days are filled with grief, and his occupation is sorrow. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is futile. The preacher moves from kind of the external problem of inheritance, stuff, to the internal toll on the heart. Think about how you have been wired for this, primed for this. In third grade, the teacher asks, "Hey, what do you want to do when you grow up?" Because we want to take a picture of it and we want to put it on the wall, or think our kids, they made like coasters or something like that and bring them home. And it's like, what do you want to do when you grow up, or what do you want to be when you grow up? And the answer is not, "Well, I think I would like to be an honorable man. I think I would like to do good things that are hard. I think I want to be a woman who loves well, serves others, want to be humble." And what the prompt is setting that third grader up for, the answer is a job description, right? Do you want to be one of these four things? A doctor, a lawyer, a nurse, or a teacher? oh yeah, those are my options, right? Do you want to be a mom, a mechanic, whatever it is, right? And then you think, well, okay, we grow out of that. But then in college, you're asked 1,000 times in dorm room lobbies, 3 questions. What's your name? Where are you from? Because your accent's weird. And what's your major? And it's really the same question. What do you want to be when you grow up? Who are you going to be? What's your major? What's your end game? What are you going to do for the next 40 years of your life? Every day, what are you going to complain about for the next 40 years? That's the question. And you think, well, but eventually you grow out of that. And that's not true. As an adult, it's the first question. You sit down at dinner with someone, or like after you're parallel walking with someone and you get past the weather, then it's like, okay, well, so what do you do? It just comes out. What do you do? Who are you? What is the sum of the work of your hands? And for some, you answer confidently, "Hey, this is what I've done." And for some, you're just begging, "Please don't ask, because I don't want to have to tell you the failure that I am." For what does a person get with all his work? This is a searching question about the net profit of the soul. And he's asking, after the taxes and fees and all those things are paid, and after the barns are built, what is left inside the man or the woman? What are you? And the answer is devastating. Our days are full of sorrow and grief. And if he's to be trusted, someone who had it all, those are not occasional visitors, those are constant companions. Even in the night, his heart does not rest, right? In the ancient world, sleep was like a reflection of your relationship with the gods. And if you weren't sleeping, like there was some disharmony somewhere, right? And in his context, it's still true to be unable to sleep because of striving was a sign that there's just something off. And the word heart, the heart does not rest, or the word mind, it's the same thing in Hebrew. It's the seat of the will and the mind. It's the essence of who we are. It's the core of us, at the center of us. It means his mind is chasing even when his body is laying flat. This is where the wind of toil starts to feel like a hurricane force wind blowing through the homes of our heart. They say you can tell what someone's God is by what keeps them up. Right? What are you wrestling with at 3 a.m.? And look, this list could go on and on and on, but just if your God is success, then you lie awake rehearsing the presentation. And if your God is approval, then you lie awake replaying conversations where you felt judged. And if you could just, gosh, if I could have just said this instead of this, then what they're thinking of me right now might be different. I could change their perception of me. Or if your God is control, then maybe you lie awake trying to solve problems that belong to next month, or in this case, next generation after you're gone. The hard work of restless sorrow is the result of trying to find Sabbath in our own productivity. And Sabbath, you might think, well, that's a day that's talked about in the Old Testament, or like it. Sabbath is the gift of rest from God, and it shows up in lots of ways. It's this idea that if I could just get one more thing done, then I can finally let my soul rest. And maybe this shows up in seasons of your life. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're saying it doesn't show up at all. But for me, I have seasons where I leave this place. I mean, this place. You don't know this. I work other than Sundays. I have a job around here. You think this is the only time that I work, and like that must be nice, but those that work around here, we actually work a lot, right? And we work on days other than Sundays. And most days I go home and I find my wife, you know, in the dining room or in the kitchen or in the living room. It's like I can just feel it on me. I can feel that she can read, like, am I at rest or not? Because I didn't get all the things done because the work is never done, right? Under the sun, there is a to-do list that is infinite. There is no done check mark that leads to peace that's accompanied by the work of these hands. It cannot be done. And listen, I hear you. Other person, don't think that you're exempt if you err on the other side, the other ditch of this idolatry. Maybe you're a procrastinator. Maybe you put things off. You're just on the other side of the ditch. You serve yourself by putting off work to grant yourself momentary comfort. But then you spend your night in unrest about what you have to do rather than what has already been done. Like, I don't want you to hear all of this and think, well, whew, that's not for me because I'm not like a successful person with like an important job. So this isn't for me. It is for you. It's also for those who are insecure because what they do paints a picture of who they are that they wish was different. The fear of, so what do you do? We talk about this every week here, but we live in the most restless era in history, and life it's easier than ever. We have every labor-saving device imaginable. Right now, there are people in this room who's got a little robot vacuuming your floors. Right now. It's doing it right now. So when you get home, no dog hair. Try explaining that to a Roman in the first century. And look, and then tell them how bad your day is. Yet, we are the most emotionally exhausted people to ever live. And we haven't just brought our work home, but we've made our work our identity. And the overlap consumes us. So when your identity is tied to your toil, the work of your hands, then a bad day at work isn't just a bad day. It's an existential crisis that creeps into every part of your life. Our hearts cannot rest because our barns are never quite big enough to make us feel safe. Those in my community group and some friends of mine, they know that for me this shows up in writing sermons. And my worst fear is that it's Friday and I'm like, I don't know. Right? I heard of someone that's like, oh, I write on Fridays. I'm like, you write what on Fridays? Like, what? Yeah, I'll get to it. Like I'm worried about a sermon that I'll preach 4 weeks from now, right? Today, right now, I'm worried about it. What it reveals about me is this need for the buffer. So I'm just unsettled. And then I think to myself, yeah, like heading into Ecclesiastes, I was 2 weeks ahead, but man, I wasn't 3 weeks. And it would be really nice to be a full month ahead. And look, there's nothing wrong with that. But that is a reflection of what it is that I'm trying to find my rest in. And my guess is if I had 6 months, sermons framed, intros written, then I would be like, that's great, but like, gosh, 6 months. Whew. That will never happen. Don't worry. We talk a lot about resting in Christ, and we should. Like, he is our rest. But this passage shows us why it's so hard. Because we're addicted to the sorrow of our own striving. It's as if we like it. That's why he says, I leaned into it fully. The sorrow of my striving. We feel like if we stop worrying, then the world will stop spinning, or maybe even just our world will stop spinning. We have forgotten that we are creatures, not the creator. And when we forget that basic reality, then we try to fill the roles of redeemer and sustainer. So we find ourselves being the one creating and redeeming and sustaining, and those are roles that we are painfully under, like, hear me, underqualified, completely unqualified for in our own lives, let alone the lives of those who come after us. Two quotes to kind of tie this point up. Tim Keller talks about idolatry a lot, and he talks about work in his book, Every Good Endeavor, and he says, if you find your identity in your work, then you will be driven by the need to achieve and haunted by the fear of failure. Your work will never be just work. It will be a way to justify your existence. And that is a burden no human heart was meant to carry, right? And you could plug anything in there for work. You could plug anything in there. And you could plug anything in this. Maybe you've heard this before, that work is a good gift and work is a terrible God. And so we have this complicated existence with toil, the fruit of our hands. Ruth Jo Simon says, when we live as if our worth is found in our productivity, we aren't just tired, we are effectively saying that Christ's work wasn't enough. That's what we're saying. That's what our hearts are saying. True rest isn't a break from work. It's a break from the need to prove ourselves through our work. So don't hear me and hear all this and be like, honey, I'm quitting my job. That is not what this... You will probably get up tomorrow and you will do what you've done for the last 20 years. And look, that's okay. My hope is that you just view it a little differently. The third thing is this: the hard work of pleasing God. There is nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I have seen that even this is from God's hand. This is different. It's like he's having a good day. Because who can eat and enjoy life apart from him, apart from God? He's giving us a perspective. If you eat, drink, and enjoy, if that is your life to do those things, you'll be troubled all the days of your life. But if eat, drink, enjoy is a gift from God, then you can find delight in the gratitude of a hard day's work. He goes on, for the person who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give to the one who is pleasing in God's sight. This too is futile, and it's a pursuit of the wind. This is the first time in the book where the sun kind of breaks through the clouds. This is a theological shift. Right, the phrase under the sun is absent here. All the heaviness he's been talking about, it's different. Instead, we see from the hand of God. So he's, for a moment, he peeks his head above the sun, above the clouds, for a moment to see the source of it all. That this is bigger than just under the sun. It's bigger than just here and now. It's bigger than just these things, but it's about the one who has made all of these things. For the first time, we hear that something is good. It is good to eat, drink, and find enjoyment in your work. But notice the source. This isn't humanly achieved. It is divinely received. It's a perspective shift. So we ask, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Right? He's diagnosing, or maybe he's doing an autopsy of life under the sun. And he says, you can have the finest steak and the most expensive wine, and you can have the biggest barns in the county or in the country. But God is the one who provides the appetite, and God is the one who provides the peace to enjoy those things. Without him, you're just a guy. You're just a girl with a full stomach, full barn, and an empty soul. He lets this reveal two types of workers, two types of toilers. He says, to the sinner, God gives the business of gathering, a treadmill that never sleeps, it never stops. But to the one who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. Right, he's painting two pictures. One who lives in light of God, his goodness, his glory, his gift. One who is a child of God and one who is not. One who lives outside of God, outside of who he is, outside of joy from him. And so he says this word to the one who pleases him. That might feel like a weight for you. And like many, you might say, well, who can do that? But pleasing God here, it's not legalism. It's the discipline of delight. It's the hard work of stopping the chase long enough to accept your lot, to stop trying to be the sovereign and start being the child receiving from God. This is the gift of our ordinary, the gift of the day in, day out. The true gain of your work is not the promotion. It's not the bonus. It's not stock options. It's the ability to sit at your dinner table tonight, maybe with yourself, maybe with family, maybe with friends, and to be able to enjoy a meal because you know your soul is secure. To be able to just sigh deeply. When you work to please him rather than to build a monument with your name on it, the night changes and the internal thoughts show up in a different voice. No longer condemning, but building up. And you can sleep not because the work is done, but because you realize the world is sustained by His hand, not your success or failure. So the question is, how do we please Him? To those who please Him, how do we do that? That seems like more burden by our own perfect work. No. We please Him by being united to the Son in whom the Father was well pleased. All right, we're talking about work and money and barns and retirements. And suddenly we shift and we look above the Son. And we're talking about the works that satisfy us before God. Jesus is the one who worked with perfect wisdom and skill. And when you realize that, that the good news of Jesus is that He has done all the pleasing of God needed for you to be loved and cherished and welcome into the family, into the household of God today and forever, then we can finally receive that Sabbath that we've been striving for all along. Jesus is the one who handed over His legacy. You want to talk about justice? Jesus is the one who handed over His legacy to heirs, to us, to you and me, to all who believe. And here's the thing, we did not work for it. We could not earn it. Don't you get it? We are not the hard worker in this analogy, but the indebted recipient of an inheritance that we did nothing to gain. And so Jesus is the one who enables us to look at our barns and say, these are fine, but they are not my life. If we go back to Luke 12, we see the full picture. The rich fool in Luke 12 wasn't a fool because he had barns. He wasn't a fool because he had bigger barns. He was a fool because he thought he was the master of the harvest. He was the sinner of verse 26, burdened with the business of gathering, but unable to enjoy a single crumb of his success. But us, we don't have to live that way. We can be rich toward God by realizing that the greatest gain, the bottom line of your hard work, isn't what you've collected, it's not what you've gathered, it's not what you've scraped together along the way, but it's that you've found the one who holds all things in the midst of that work. You found rest. And we find rest because God first finds us. That trailer, that U-Haul, it still won't follow you to the grave. Grave robbers will come in and loot the pyramids and the barns of your life that we've spent our life filling. But for the child of God, hear me, that's okay. Because we're heading to a house that we didn't build, to eat a feast that we didn't cook, provided by a Father who has already given us everything. Not because of anything that we've done, but because the one whom we build our life upon, the grace given to us in Christ alone. And whether you leave your kids a college fund or a trailer full of debt, leave them this inheritance. Point them above all to the one who holds an imperishable inheritance. Point them to the King of all kings, the Creator, Redeemer, Sustainer of all. As the band comes up, I'll close out with a quote from the pastor Charles Spurgeon. He says, "I have learned to kiss the wave that throws me against the rock of ages. If the wind of toil blows away your barns, let it. If it sweeps away your name, let it. For if you are rich toward God, you have a treasure that no fool can inherit and no grave can hold." I mean, the pharaohs tried to build stone structures to stop the wind. The rich fool built bigger barns to hide from the wind. But look, we don't have to do that. We get to kiss the wave that throws us against the rock of ages. What a cool picture. Man, we get to respond to all this. Can sit right where we are, can stand up, can sing with the band. I think they would love that. You can pray over there at that prayer bench. There'll be a few back there. They'll have lanyards on. They would love to pray with you and bear with you. Anything that you have going on, right? This table for those who are in Christ, right? The passage talked about the sinner and the child of God. And for the child of God, we rest solely upon the work of Jesus. And that means that this table reminds us, gives us an opportunity to declare, to remember the body that was broken for us, the blood that was spilled for us, to open this table up, and we take the bread and the cup. And we do this in remembrance of him who opened up the table in the Lord's house for us. Right? If that's you, and this is open to you as we reflect with some questions on the screen, and if you're not in that place, you've never come to the place where you said, man, I don't want my life to stand before God in judgment in the end. I want Christ's life to stand between me and judgment. I want to stake my life and my death on that, right? If you've never done that, this is not for you. We are for you. We would love to pray with you and process any of this stuff. Would you pray with me? Father, thanks for your word, your kindness to us, your warning to our hearts that we would stop living lives just riddled with the lack of peace because of the way that we engage with toil, work, possessions, stuff, and those who come after us. Would you let those things not frustrate as we consider injustice, but would you let your injustice, that you took the death that was aimed at us so that we might have life that we never could gain on our own, would you let that shape the way that we work tomorrow, the way that we leave our legacy in days to come? In Jesus' name, amen.